Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
All right, welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm your host, Kara Robinson Chamberlain, and this is your other host,
Kimberly Corbin.
And today you're going to hear Kim's story. You heard episode one, my story. We want to make sure that you guys know who we are and why we are here, why we're sharing our stories, and why what we have to say matters. So one of the most important parts of explaining that to you is telling you guys our stories. So today is Kim's turn to share her story.
Before we really get started, I do want to point out we're going to be discussing sexual assault, trauma, violence, some things that can be really triggering. And as with all of these episodes, make sure you're in the headspace to listen to these. You may not even catch it until halfway through and be like, oh, that's not sitting right with me. It's okay to turn it off. You're not going to hurt our feelings. We probably won't ever know. So take a minute, take a breath, do whatever you need to for your own self-care. Again, Kara and I have talked about these things in depth over and over the years. So for us to ask each other questions, it's not weird. I think that common times we'll see an interview and it's like, cringe with how someone has to answer or something. That's not the vibe here at all. I'm very open, as is Kara, to talking about any aspect of this because I think it's important for people to know, A, it's not your fault, and B, whatever you experienced is normal.
I also want to mention, because this is our second episode and we are kind of setting the stage for what you can expect here, most of our episodes will not include a deep dive or even our guests telling their stories to the extent with which you will experience with my episode and with Kim's episode. So that's why we're giving you the trigger warnings. That's why we are giving you the advice to take this in when you are in the headspace to do so. Our further episodes will focus more on the after and the healing aspects. So we just want to make sure that you know what to expect and that you know how to take care of yourself when and if you decide to consume these stories in their entirety. We would love for you to consume these in full, but we just want to make sure that you know what to expect. So without further ado, Kim, tell us about who you were before you became a victim of a serious crime.
Born in Illinois, but raised in Colorado with my family. I have one brother. I'm the oldest child. My parents are still together after many, many years. And I describe my upbringing as kind of living in the bubble. I did every sport imaginable. I was involved with everything. I mean, nothing really crazy, outlandish. I didn't experience trauma. I have a wonderful family from both sides, still living back in Illinois. We grew up going constantly across I-80, visiting them. And yeah, life was pretty great. So I graduated high school from Northridge in 2004 in Greeley. And we're about an hour north of Denver or so. And I wanted to go to the University of Northern Colorado, which is also in Greeley, but on the other side of town from where I grew up, because they have an awesome business college. I remember going on the campus tours, you know, and I walked into the business school and there's the ticker tape for the stock market up and around like the inside of the little foyer that when you walk in, I was like, ooh, that's cool. I want to be here.
Never in my life would I have experienced that.
Yeah. So I applied, was accepted, and I started there in the fall of 2004. The great thing that my parents pushed me to do instead of living at home and going to college was to live in the dorms, get the full college experience. And I did. I didn't go home and spend the night at my house that I'd grown up in since I was in kindergarten until like Thanksgiving break. So I made really great friends with my roommates, friends that I had already been friends with in high school. It was just really cool. But by the time spring semester in 2005, I was kind of feeling like, I'm not involved in anything. And after having been involved in everything before that, I knew I needed to do something. My cousins back east had been involved in fraternity and sorority life. If you would have known me before, you'd be like, you did what? Because it was majorly sports. And I went through house tours in the spring of 2005, fell in love with Alpha Phi, and ended up making my very best friends there. Sophomore year, we lived in the house on campus. So much fun. I also think this is an important part to point out. I didn't drink in high school. The high school sports CHASA rules scared the crap out of me and I didn't want to be ineligible. And so I never drank. And then I get to college and it's like the first weekend there. And I'm at a party where a guy's stirring jungle juice in a bathtub with the arm hair. Blech. I was like, I really don't drink. Oh, that's fun. Just eat the fruit. But that being said, like, I'm experiencing college life and drinking and having new friends and all of these things at the beginning. So it really wasn't like I went to school in my hometown. By the time junior year is approaching, we are finishing up living in the house and are going to move off campus. We were looking more towards the west side of Greeley because historically speaking, that's the newer side. There's less crime and it was closer to where I grew up. So we moved out west to two ground floor apartments. And I remember going there and the gal who sold them to us for the lease for the year was boasting that there was no crime. There is absolutely no crime reported in these college apartments. It was predominantly college kids or like really young families. Great. So we split up three and three into these ground floor apartments and we're moving in for the last week of school. Basically just looking forward to a whole summer of working and hanging out by the pool and enjoying being 20 years old. On the night of May 11th, 2006, my boyfriend had come over to watch me build furniture. One of my roommates left, went to stay at her boyfriend's house on campus, and the other one was there. My boyfriend left, and she and I were cleaning. I clean meticulously. I'm sort of a neat freak, which is so funny because my kids are not, and it makes my eye twitch. I like cleanliness and order. But that being said, I was wiping everything down and getting my room just the way that I wanted it and hanging pictures and all that good stuff. My roommate and I had a single glass of wine. She went to bed about midnight or so, and then I stayed up and I was cleaning and hanging pictures and whatnot. About 1:30, I called and left a voicemail for my boyfriend, laid in bed, and fell asleep. The next thing I remember is feeling like I couldn't breathe, and something was really hot. Like my breath was hot on my face. I was laying on my stomach, and I pushed myself up off of my bed. And was immediately pushed back down into my pillow. And I just hear this low, taunting voice in my ear saying, shut up. Shut the fuck up. Don't say anything. And I knew something was really, really wrong. This man continued to ask if my roommate and I were friends. He used her name. He used my name. And then he said, you two need to stop being little bitches to everybody. And I was just dumbstruck. Who could we possibly have pissed off this badly that he would be in my room, in my bed, sometime in the middle of the night, having been uninvited? And all of these thoughts were racing through my head. I feel like, you know how we were just talking about this? You can speed up an audiobook and listen to it at like insane rates. That's how quickly all of these thoughts are going through my head. Where are my roommates? Are they safe? Does he have them? What time is it? Where is all of this happening? And from there, he proceeded to sexually assault me. And I had to lay in my own bed at 20 years old, believing that was how I was going to die. I thought about the last thing that I said to my parents, to my brother, to my friends. I had to wonder who was going to find me. Is anybody going to find me? Because I knew that he was going to kill me. He kept my face covered for the majority of the assault. And I did all of the things that we're taught, you know, at that age to do. So first lie that came to my head is like, oh, you don't want to do this. I have herpes. That was the first thing I could think of. But I didn't stop him. And then I said, I have to go to the bathroom. I have to pee. Didn't stop him. And finally, I kept telling him throughout the course of this assault that I'm claustrophobic, that he needs to move the shirt off of my face. And twice, he moved it just enough that I was able to see from about mid-bridge of his nose up and about mid-calf down. And other than that, my face was covered by this black shirt. I always feel weird about when I'm asked to describe the assault itself because it wasn't violent. He said some things that really stick out to me, and he moved me in a way that I knew I couldn't go against, but also it wasn't like he's grabbing really hard or throwing me or anything. It wasn't violent. I think even in the first time I talk about it, I said he treated it like it was a date. It was weird. And I had to lay there and catalog all these things. And I realized I can't get away. I can't do the stuff that I thought that I would always be able to do. I can't run or fight or kick or scream. If I'm going to get revenge, and this is literally the words that I had in my mind, 2006, if I'm going to get revenge, I'm going to have to do it in court. I'm being assaulted, and this is where my mind's at. When he finished his assault, he ejaculated on my upper left thigh, and I knew right then that that was evidence. And so with that thought process in mind, he rolled me over to the side. And so I had to kind of turn my leg up so that it didn't transfer to my sheets or my comforter. But that's when I was able to see out my bedroom window. There was about a 2-inch opening in the blinds from the bottom of the window frame to the blinds where I could see out. And my window faced the back of some parking garages. So I could see the plants and the sidewalk and these parking garages. And that's how I was able to tell how much time was passing, because I was watching the sunrise. There's this pre-dawn blue hue that was coming through the windows, and that's how I was judging how much time there was. At one point, I felt something really hard press against the back of my head, which I had assumed was some kind of firearm. But at one point, I was also able to see that he had a video camera. He had brought this, it looked like a Sony Handycam type camera, with him and was trying to record it. And I kept waiting to hear the beep. I grew up like with a family of paparazzi. We were taking pictures and videos of literally everything. I had my own little Hi-8, you know, those little cassette tapes that you used to record on. I had my own tapes, and we'd make like magic shows and all kinds of stuff. So this camera was really familiar to me. And I kept waiting to hear that beep. That means you're recording, and I never heard it. And so he rolls me onto my side, and knowing that he just finished his assault, I'm thinking, okay, this is the part where he's going to kill me. And I had remembered reading in some magazine like Cosmo or whatever a few years before about a woman who was abducted out of her work parking lot. The guy drove her out into the middle of nowhere and sexually assaulted her. But she convinced him that they were going to date, that they were going to be friends, all this stuff, and held hands all the way back. And he let her go. And so I decided to try the same tact. And I started talking to him. And he answered. And he talked. And then he wouldn't stop talking. And over the next hour, I'm watching the sunrise as I'm talking to this man, and I can't figure out who he is. I don't recognize his voice from anywhere, but I am doing my level best to gather as much information as I can while also making him believe that I'm not going to tell anyone. I'm embarrassed. My boyfriend would be so mad. My family's coming in for my brother's graduation. They would just be crushed. I'm not going to do that to them. So I'm coming up with all of these reasons why this was my fault. Knowing full well that a very black and white line had been crossed, I knew what happened to me was a crime. I harbored no guilt whatsoever from the get-go, which is very different from a lot of people who experience crimes like these. And after a while, he said he was going to wait for my roommate to come back because we needed to have a little chat. And I came up with another lie that said, oh, you know, her parents are coming up to take her down to Denver for her grandma's birthday, blah, 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 whatever I could come up with. And so he decides he's going to leave. But before he does that, he says, well, I'm going to come back for you. I'm going to make sure something really nice happens for you. And I'm going to come back and you're going to know it's me. And he was standing up and he'd like look at my picture frames, and I can kind of hear him because, again, I'm facing my window, can only see a little bit, and he's behind me. And I hear him do this like, huh, huh, kind of sound. And then he sat back down. He said, you know, I just feel really bad about this. This is going to ruin my day. And I took my hand and put it up on my shoulder where his hand was resting. And I said, it's okay. Everybody makes mistakes. He kissed the top of my head, stood up, and asked for a drink of water. So I told him to go to the wrong cupboard, thinking, hey, maybe he'll leave fingerprints. We were just cleaning the night before. And so I hear him walk down the hallway, open the cupboard, close it, open another cupboard, hear the water and the cup in the sink. And then I hear my front door open and close. I cannot catch my breath for whatever reason. I think it's because I can hear my breathing in the microphone.
I mean, it's also just like telling your story. And also the fact that dissociation is hard when you are telling your story in this point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like it's a little bit more difficult. So I think it's normal.
Every once in a while, I do let myself like get into the memory and feel it as opposed to just relay it.
Mm-hmm.
That's heavy. I don't know how much you've done that before. It's like you can just tell like the back of your hand, but if something disrupts it or like you get off of that track that you've practiced, it can be really draining and depleting.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that was kind of my experience with the movie. I had been telling this story in my head of all the things that happened, and then to see it acted out in front of me, it was very, very different. So yeah, anything that takes you out of that monotonous repetition of your story can kind of take you off guard. I think that's normal.
I guess that did it for me too, because I've heard you tell your story enough that then seeing it brought to life was like, oh my God. Oh, I cried just a little bit.
I mean, listen, I think I've had people asking me, you know, how was it? Did you experience PTSD? And I didn't really experience PTSD, but there were times when I was watching certain scenes be filmed where I was like, I need to take a snack because I'm having some feelings. So,
well, it's animating your snapshot memories that you talked about.
Yeah, it's filling in those gaps, which is, you know, I was talking to you while I was there. And that was the thing that I realized is I have these snapshot memories. And then the movie was like filling in those gaps very much where I was like, oh, yeah, that did happen. It's very weird because, you know, PTSD, which I was like, I don't have PTSD. Number one symptom is memory loss. So maybe I do.
Shocker. Yeah. We are learning so much.
So,
yeah, I hear the front door open and close, and I'm immediately looking out my blinds to see if he'll run by. And he doesn't. But at the same time, I'm grabbing my cell phone, which was sitting on my bookcase headboard next to a hammer, a knife, all kinds of things that I had been putting up my pictures with the night before. And I immediately call 911. And it makes that really loud blink sound. And I muffle it and I wait because I didn't see him walk by. He could still be in my apartment. Nothing happens. It's completely silent. I call again, and this time I let it connect. There is a recording of my 911 call that I myself put on YouTube because as part of my keynote speeches, I introduced that call because I think it's important for people to understand the trauma in the moment after it happens. Sounds very different than me standing here or sitting retelling it. And I don't want that contrast to be lost. So I put it on YouTube as an educational purpose. And now it's been, oh my gosh, viewed millions and millions of times. So I hope there's enough resources and things for people there. But I don't have first person memory of half of that call. I know that when dispatch connected, I had gotten up out of bed, carefully moving the sheets back because that DNA evidence was still on my thigh. I walked down the side of the hallway because our carpeting had just been cleaned and there were fresh foot impressions in the carpeting from where he'd been wearing shoes. I walked over to, or ran over to our front door and used the tips of my acrylic nails to deadbolt and make sure that it was locked. And then I ran into my roommate's room, busted through the door, and I'm asking her for our address because I was trying to give the cross streets. We'd only been living there for a week because school had just ended. And I was confusing part of our address at the Alpha Phi house that we'd lived in for a year with this new one that we'd only had for a week. But I knew the cross streets and I was trying to do that. And she asks, what happened? The dispatcher asks, okay, what happened? And I scream that I was raped. That's the first time my roommate is hearing it. She sees me in nothing but a pink tank top, standing there with no bottoms on the phone, clearly frazzled. And having a complete meltdown, screaming that I was raped. That's how she woke up that morning. I have no memory after that point. Now, it's been explained to me in counseling and therapy afterwards that it was the first measure of safety that I likely felt. And so my brain, which had been firing on all cylinders, shut down. It's not as if I wasn't aware of what was going on, but when you ask me about it in memory, I can't remember. I know that I went into my closet and I got the baggiest sweatpants that I could find. They were from soccer in high school. I went into the bathroom and I peed in a cup in case there was any evidence that might have come out. And then I got a towel and I stood on that towel until the first officers arrived and I made sure that my roommate didn't touch me. At one point, she had called my parents who lived about 10 minutes away. And so when the officers all started coming in through the apartment, like all of these different pieces, I could go on and on about because they're all so important and have so many ramifications and mean so many things. But in my first person experience, you know, the first thing I remember is being asked these questions when I'm sitting on the couch and the officer has his little pad of paper in front of me. It's the spiral ring. Okay. Then what? And what hand and what side? If you don't already know, you're going to learn this season that I am a bit of a caffeinated chipmunk when I talk. So I'm wanting to talk. Like, I have all of this information. He's been talking to me for an entire hour. I want to get it all out as quickly as possible so you can find this guy. But the officer kept slowing me down and he's like, okay, I need to know like specific, like super specific questions, which was pissing me off, quite frankly. But at the same time, I now know how important that was because that initial statement that officers take or a forensic nurse takes or a crisis advocate takes is very, very important because it lays the groundwork for an entire case. The sergeant that was on duty that day came up in the middle of this conversation and she said, you know, hi, my name's Sergeant Susie West. And I was wondering, do you want a victim advocate to come out? What the heck is that? I've never had more than a speeding ticket. And she says, you know, it's somebody that comes out from the department. And they're just here to be with you throughout the day. They're going to answer your questions. And I'm like, I don't need that. I have laser focus on what I need to do and what I need to get done. But my roommates, my family, my boyfriend, they all really do because I can't comfort them in this moment, which is usually my role. That's what I do. So three advocates came out that day and my parents will tell you they were worth their weight in gold. They did an amazing job of just being there when needed and then kind of fading away when they didn't. When my parents arrived at my apartment, the door was obviously open. There's tons of officers walking through. And I just remember the look on my mom's face was sheer just terror and depleted. And she's crying and all she wanted to do was hug me. My dad's standing right behind her and he does this thing with his jaw when he's clenching it and trying not to emote. And the muscle flexes right in his back of his jaw. And he's trying to do that, but you can tell he's welling up with tears and wants to be strong for his family. And I wouldn't let them hug me because I knew that my body was a walking crime scene. I don't know how I knew that. I don't know what instinct told me to not be affectionate with my parents or to not do the one thing that felt natural was seeking comfort. But I did. And that was a pretty smart move in retrospect. They asked then if I wanted to ride with my parents to sane examination, the hospital. And I didn't feel safe. This guy knew a lot about me, my roommates, my boyfriend, where I worked, all kinds of stuff. And I wanted to ride with the detectives. So I'm in the back of the detective's car, which was a first for me. Hey, I'm literally cracking jokes with them about the new department that's being built. Within like 20 minutes of this guy being in my apartment, it was hindsight, so weird. But guess what, everybody? This is the part where we're going to footnote. This is a common trauma response. So making light of the situation, humor is a huge part of my life in general. And that just doesn't go away because there's trauma. So I was cracking jokes with them. We get to the hospital and we walk in and there's this amazing nurse who was a forensic nurse. She takes me back for 3 hours. We undergo the sane examination. Now, this in itself is a whole episode that I could go into, but for the sake of time, it's 13 steps and the three things that Jennifer, was her name, did amazingly with was first, she would tell me what they needed. I have to take a sample of your hair. Then she'd tell me why. She said, I need a sample of your hair to establish your DNA without any kind of mixture. And third, which was most important, she asked my permission. Can I take a sample of your hair? Now, me being eager people pleaser with all of this information to give, I'm grabbing clumps of my hair. Like, here, is this enough? We complete the exam. My mom comes in. At some point, there's food. I don't want any of it. They keep asking me if I want breaks. And it was really tough because I'm like, no, I just want to get through this. You need all of this information to catch this guy. And I rode with the officers again and we went to the police station. And this one was nice because I actually got to sit in a room that was audio and video recorded and can talk at my normal pace instead of having to wait for somebody to write it down. And I just went through and found they're on DVDs. You were talking about how you have all of the evidence, as do I. I was just going through these old DVDs and it's so weird to see me and how I'm sitting there with my parents. We're waiting for the detectives to come in and I'm in my Greek week shirts and my voice is me, but it's different. Like it's still higher pitched and I'm just sitting there talking and it's so out of body is the best way I can describe it. Like I have my memory of it. And then to see it again, pieced together on video is, it was weird. But I was there for about 3 hours, went through, gave them as much of a statement as I could. And then they're like, okay, well, that's all we have for today. And we'll call you if we have anything. And so where do I go? I can go home. I'm not going back to my apartment. he had broken in, and I didn't feel comfortable going to my parents because he knew all this about me. The next 3 weeks were a total blur. And I always find it interesting when you and I tell our stories side by side, this is the part that, like, the adrenaline is high, all hands on deck, everyone looking. And while, yes, it's the same for me, that elongated, what was yours, three days in between, right? So 3 days into 3 weeks, but on that 3 weeks to the day, they finally found him. And it wasn't like they had a suspect. I think that's the biggest part. They knew in yours who they were looking for, where he might have been going. They had people to interview. This was canvassing of literally anyone that I've ever met, and boyfriends of friends, like anybody in the Greek community, everybody in that whole area of the apartment complex. Like, it impacted everybody. You want to talk? Let's talk about ripple effects. Here it is. So 3 weeks to the day, I get a call from the detective that we've had a lot of back and forth. I've been there giving more statements. I found out very quickly he's the same sarcastic sense of humor. So we really hit it off, and it wasn't weird or out of the blue to get a call. They asked me to come down to the station. Well, I was about to head to work, and I said, oh, can it wait? No, it really can't wait. So my parents take me down. We go into the station, and when I walk into this detective's office, there are all these individual bags, evidence bags of women's underwear. And they asked me if I recognize any of them. And I'm going down the line, and nope, none of them. And I don't care how many pairs of underwear you have, like, you know which ones are yours, right? But none of them popped out at me. Like, all right, we thought we had something. So I leave, and I drive the half an hour or whatever it is to work. And I'm in the bathroom of a fine family dining establishment, Hooters. And I'm putting on my scrunchy socks, and I get another call from the detective. Hey, can you come back? Can you ask my manager this time? Because I really don't want to leave. Well, half an hour later, the cops show up and take the Hooter girl away. I'm sure that looked real classy. This time when I went in, though, there was a ton of officers, plain clothes, patrol, all kinds of people. And I go into this tiny little room, and there's six armed detectives. I'm like, okay, we have somebody in custody, and we want to see if you'll be able to recognize him. And I was like, no, I know I'm not going to be able to, because I couldn't do a sketch knowing that I only saw half of his face. And so the detective had an idea. He put on headphones, much like the ones that I'm wearing right now. And then he played this video. And so I'm holding the headphones on my ears, and I'm listening, and I hear him talking. And then all of a sudden, I hear that same low, taunting voice come through those headphones and into my ears. And it did not matter how many people were in between me and him. He said he was coming back for me and he was going to find me. And I absolutely lost it and started panicking. I had a panic attack right there in front of those detectives, and they had to take me back out to my parents to calm me down. And it didn't matter that they didn't have DNA or anything else. That voice was burned into the back of my mind for the rest of eternity. And I knew that they had the right person. Earlier in that day, there were two officers that were fresh out of FTO, and they reported to a call for trespassing at a neighboring apartment complex. So it's like a half a mile away from mine that we were at. They show up, the guy's in the gymnasium area, and he's taking pictures of women that are out by the pool sunbathing. The manager had asked him to leave, and he said no, of course, because ego gets him in the way for most of these people. The officers show up. They realize really quickly, like, he matches the voice patterns and the description that we've been hearing about in briefing for these last 3 weeks. So they take him in on trespassing. He's got a gym bag with him that has a video camera and women's underwear. And he was in this interview with different detectives for 7.5 hours. Never asked for an attorney. Never said that he did it, but he also never said that he didn't. Once I made that identification, they told him that's what he's being charged with. And all of that is later evidence and used at trial. But that was the first time that I actually slept soundly. Now, the manager of that apartment complex had also made a note of this same guy who had been there doing this 3 weeks prior. He went over and she documented that she had asked him to leave in the afternoon of May 12th, which was the same day that I was assaulted. So he was back at it. You know how it was going to ruin his day. He was back at it that quickly, picking out his next victim. This case gets moved over to court, and you're going to hear a lot about the court process and trial and victim advocacy and things throughout the course of our interviews with everyone else. And we'll do some of this throughout episodes, but that's really the courtroom drama piece that you'd see on Law and Order or whatever it is, plays out over a 16-month time frame. I had to get legally savvy very quickly, and thankfully my parents were super involved, but every single time that there was a hearing, whether it was just disposition or continuance or whatever it ended up being, there were always about 80 people that were in that courtroom showing the ripple effect that it had. One incident, one sex assault had on so many people. And still to this day, the stiletto shoes on tile when it's that many of them remind me of those court cases, but it felt good knowing that there were so many people that were behind me throughout that. We're going to talk a lot about mental health as well throughout the course of this podcast. And I didn't suffer from anything. I was completely fine and normal. Right? Right?
And the narrator says, that was a lie.
And the lie detector test determined that was a lie. So I was the last person around me to realize that I was having PTSD and panic attacks.
And what was your impression before you realized of what PTSD was? Because I think that there are still so many misconceptions of what PTSD is. So what was your expectation of what it would look like to be impacted by this traumatic event before you realized you were affected?
Well, actually, that wasn't something I had ever really thought about. If I'd heard the word or that acronym, I might have attributed it with military. Mm-hmm. But besides that, like, it just wasn't a topic of conversation then at all. Like, you didn't discuss mental health. The only people that went to therapy were crazy or rich or both.
And I feel like during this time frame, our expectations of what it looked like to be traumatized, mm-hmm, were what we had seen on TV. It's kind of like before you have a baby and your expectations of what labor is, mm-hmm, it's on TV. And then you realize it's really nothing like that. So
they never showed you pooping and on TV.
Right. So I think our expectations, and this is one thing that we have had in common, my expectation of what it looked like to be impacted by this traumatic event was to be curled up in a corner crying.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Inconsolable, couldn't be near men. But that's not what I experienced. So I must have been fine. And I hear you saying the same thing.
Well, and it's almost like your mind is warring with itself, because you'll laugh at something or you'll feel joy in a moment. And you're like, wait, I just went through something that I know should be massively traumatic. I'm not allowed to feel that way, right? What's wrong with me? And so we've almost gaslit ourselves into what we think we should be doing to respond, but it also made it so that I didn't catch that until everyone else around me is telling me, like, you're not you right now. But the things that I was doing to act through that trauma looked very similar to college experiences, right? Binge drinking, normal college experience. Promiscuity. You're going to make out with two guys at the bar? Oh my gosh, she's such a slaughter. XYZ. Trauma response, right? There's all these different things that, oh yeah, whatever, it was college. But in my mind, unbeknownst to me, I'm doing this as a way to try to prove that I have power, control over my own life, over my body, over my emotions, and failing miserably, mind you. So even though I was going to therapy, it wasn't helping at all, because I'd sit on the couch and put on my people-pleasing smile and I'm fine, really. And it wasn't until I started having panic attacks that morphed into what are called psychogenic non-epileptic seizures related to PTSD that I realized I am experiencing a whole hell of a lot more than I ever anticipated or expected from myself. I got this blue trifold pamphlet the day of with all of the things that may happen as a result of being the victim of a crime. And I remember getting so pissed off. And my parents remember this. I crumpled it up like Darla on Little Rascals when she's got the pop can and like crumple it up and threw it. I'm like, I'm never going to do any of those. And now I look at it and I'm like, check, check, check every single one.
Right.
In different ways. But it's really normal to have abnormal reactions.
Right.
And so by the time trial rolled around and I'm in the midst of having these debilitating seizures, I was introduced to EMDR, to mental health, to ups and downs with school and relationships and all kinds of things. The 5-day jury trial was what I hitched my wagon to. That is the ultimate measure of justice and healing and retribution for me. And I will be the first one now to tell you, don't do that. Please, please don't do that.
That's very common, right? Like that's what I wanted. I wanted to sit in the courtroom. And so I think that's normal.
That's how the SVU episodes end, right? You have to take it to the DA and it has to go to court. And then commercial break, and then you get the conclusion and what's on next week. And for those people that it doesn't happen that way for, how are you preparing yourself to close that stress loop when it's not the justice system that's going to do that? Getting up on the stand for 3 hours was absolutely grueling, and it made me understand why so many people don't want to report. I was believed from the outset by everyone. I had what amounted to, it should have been a slam dunk case. All these positive DNA samples, everything short of a confession. And still, it was one of the hardest things that I've ever had to do. And so people who maybe don't feel that way or don't have such a on paper or perfect case, yeah, I get why you don't want to do that. And it's okay. But thankfully for me, at the end of the day, the jury found Ronnie Piros guilty of sexual assault and of burglary. And I think it's important to point out the burglary piece because it's a, quote, lesser crime, right? I don't think of being a burglary victim. And I was. And so were my roommates. Just because they weren't sexually assaulted, they still had their home and their sense of safety violated. They still experienced vicarious trauma, PTSD, as did the 3 girls in the other apartment. My boyfriend, my parents, my brother, everyone experienced this trauma in a different way for different reasons, but it's all because of one act, because of one man's choice to do this. The pre-sentencing investigation, which I found really interesting, for those of you who are law enforcement or have some kind of background with this, are going to understand a lot about it. I would have been fascinated to see Ivanovitz go through a PSI in some capacity, because I think it would have been more revealing even than the one that we got back, because for him, you're looking at a career, like lifetime criminal. Mine was someone who was likely just starting out, but they deemed he would have been, by standards today, a sexually violent predator who would have likely gone on to commit serial rapes ending in sexual homicide, as evidenced by the fact that he was there that day, that he was picking out more victims. When they served the search warrant at his house, they found all of these pairs of underwear, all of these photographs, videos, and it stuck out to me, Kara, in our conversation about your case, that they never found the legal pad of yours. Mm-hmm. They never found the tape of me.
Where is it?
Great, great freaking question. He claims that there wasn't one. He also never admitted to what he did until after he was convicted, and then magically his memory returned. That was a question that I had for years and years afterwards. And I didn't realize that Michael and Rob knew and just thought that I knew and didn't tell me. How he had first found us, which is always a common question for others too, is that we were at a Greek Week function of some kind at a bar downtown in Greeley, and we had been dancing. This dude comes up to us and tries to dance with us, and my roommate and I are doing the creeper shuffle away, you know, like, ugh. Clearly, no, please, like, go grind on a lamppost, not my leg, you. Well, that man happened to not like the answer no. He followed us home. He stalked us for an entire week, plotted his break-in, and then chose when to do that. And I just have had this conversation because January is Stalking Awareness Month. It has been 16 years, 16?
Sounds right.
Something like that, since this happened. And just yesterday, I have this moment where I'm like, oh shit, I'm a victim of stalking. Oh, no. And I'm automatically going into the thing that I tell everyone not to do. Yes, I was stalked. I didn't know that I was being stalked, though. And so I never correlated that with being a stalking victim, quote unquote, because we get in the bad habit, by no fault of our own, of addressing just the bigger crime, quote, bigger crime, or the lesser crimes like a burglary or a stalking incident or something like that simply get pushed to the side when you have something like a sex assault. Well, the problem is they found out that he had been stalking quite a few women and had a pattern of behavior that then escalated to sex assault, right? So if you're addressing those, quote, lesser crimes, you could be potentially stopping them from becoming something bigger. Mm-hmm. I think about that all the time with cases of domestic violence, violence against women in general, and mass shootings.
Yeah.
If you look through the research now, almost every single mass shooting perpetrator has a history of violence or misogyny against women or people of marginalized cultures, but almost always women.
Yeah. I just had this conversation with one of my good friends who still works in law enforcement. And she said, yeah, you know, whenever we catch someone for a burglary, on average, they've already broken into at least 20 homes before we catch them.
Yep. Well, and you look at the statistics surrounding perpetrators of sexual violence on average, and this is just the best data that they have, on average, one perpetrator creates at least 6 victims in their lifetime, at least.
Right.
That's not amount of rapes, that's amount of victims. And so if you're addressing those minor crimes first, you could potentially be stopping something bigger from happening. But you have to take those seriously. You have to start by believing when people talk about these things. We'll obviously in later episodes go more into decisions to speak out, to go public, and to take back our stories and our voices. But I think it's also important to point out that not every day is one where, you know, you and I hop on a podcast and recount everything and go on merrily with our lives, or stand up in front of huge audiences and give a keynote and then whatever else it may be. There are some days where I brushed my teeth today and that's enough.
Yeah.
There are some days where I don't feel like a survivor today. I feel like a victim. And that's okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you're backsliding. It means that you're human. And the ability to address that as it's happening shows growth.
Yeah.
It shows strength to be able to say, I am human. I am able to sit in my grief and my feelings, because grieving something like this when you've been abused is okay. You're grieving the person that you were before, the life that you thought you lived in, the dreams, hopes, aspirations, whatever it might be. You're grieving the loss of your life before.
Yeah.
And treating those symptoms maybe as grief or as something that isn't as what is looked at as shameful or guilt-ridden when you have sex assault. Think about it as a different crime. People don't behave that way. You understand the grief. You let them go through those cycles. Well, the same needs to happen when you've experienced a crime of violence like this.
Yeah. I think very often we forget about that grief piece when we are addressing trauma and sexual assault. But I'm so glad you touched on that, because it is something that is so applicable. Like, obviously, if you were the victim of a family member being murdered, grief would be very obvious. But it is so important to address that grief side of being a victim, because you have lost something. Like, regardless, right, something has been taken from you. So I think that's so important.
The decision for me to speak out came in the midst of these seizures that I was having, because suddenly I couldn't drive anymore. I had to drop back out of school. I couldn't live alone. My parents had to basically take care of me 24/7. And I'm sitting there one evening and I'm like, why did this have to happen to me? Why me? Not in a pity kind of way, but like, I need a purpose for everything. Things don't just happen for no reason at all. But what is my purpose going to be? And I decided that if I could help just one person not have to experience what I did, that would all be worth it. I made a call to the victim advocate that I was working with at the district attorney's office, who put me in touch with their community relations director. And she gave me the names of some reporters that, you know, they've worked with previously. And it was my hometown paper. A wonderful journalist who was doing things back then that should be the standard even today. And I don't know that they always are. Her name is Rebecca Boyle. She met with me about 3 different times. And finally, I was able to tell someone my story. You know, not the black and white stuff that you see in an affidavit or on the paper, or, you know, in headlines. It was my story. What happened to me and my friends and my family and the ripple effect of all of this trauma. Because I decided if that could just reach one person, that would be worth it to me. And so we got the guilty verdict and she came up to me and she's like, okay, Kim, are you sure you want to do this? Hey, look at that, consent. I said, absolutely. So the next day, the Greeley Tribune ran front page article with my name in it, which they don't typically do for victims of sex assault. And then they ran a huge front page article the second day and an op-ed from their editor's board and all kinds of stuff. And I didn't know this until many years later. But the district attorney's office in Weld County had another case that was going through at the time. And it was a 78-year-old woman who was also the victim of a stranger assault. She called her victim advocate because she'd been uncooperative to this point. She didn't want to testify. She didn't want to talk to friends or family about it. She just wanted it to go away. And she called her victim advocate and she said, you know, I read the paper this weekend and if Kim can do it, so can I. And she got up on the stand later that fall and put a serial rapist away for the rest of his life. So I didn't know it then, but it impacted one person. And so that was what I had set out to do and have kept at it for the exact same reason ever since. I started speaking just in classes to peer education groups, law enforcement, prosecutors, nurses, budding police officers, like all these different groups. And I looked at it as they all put so much into making sure that I could have the tools and the ability to heal, that this is my way of giving back. And I did that for many, many, many years. And then the pandemic comes along. And my advocacy efforts that had always been like in person or volunteering, TikTok comes along and I pivoted. I mean, I'd done some stuff on social media and whatnot, but I pivoted and started doing more on TikTok because meet your audience and your demographic that's most at risk where they are, right? Well, Kara and I found each other fairly quickly because we were some of the only victims on there, I guess. I don't know how you'd outspoken or public facing victims. And we're just there telling our stories from our houses, like, what's up? And it was shocking to so many people because it's reaching people that normally we wouldn't. And while we are used to having these conversations and working through and, you know, different therapeutic interventions or ways to help ourselves, it definitely was not something other people were prepared for. So I remember like we had DM'd and like commented back and forth on stuff and just not connected until was it BuzzFeed?
Maybe.
Yeah. And then you're like, girl, BuzzFeed just picked up my video.
That was it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And we hopped on a FaceTime call because I'd done quite a bit with media relations and all kinds of stuff in the over a decade prior. And Kara's like, what do I do here? Like,
yeah, because it went viral. That's what it was. That BuzzFeed article.
Yes.
Actually went viral. Yeah.
Yep. I just remember the first FaceTime and it was like 3 hours that we just sat there and talked like we'd known each other our entire lives.
Yeah.
And that's basically all it's ever been. I mean, it's devolved into ridiculousness ever since. But,
you know, I think one of the things that is so important to note here is that when you are sharing something so deeply vulnerable, it allows you to make connections with people on a different level that you may not normally make. And one of the things you'll hear on one of our later episodes is that there aren't often, I think it's getting better, but there's not often a lot of public facing survivors sharing their stories. It's becoming more commonplace with TikTok, honestly. I would say that's really where it kind of has started.
Yeah.
But there weren't a lot of us like at the beginning. And so you could easily make connections with people. And something just amazing happens when someone looks at you and they're just like, I get you. I understand. And you'll hear us say this over and over and over again during the course of our podcast. Like, that is why we're here, because not everyone gets to sit down and feel seen and heard on these issues. And I had similar goals as Kim when I started sharing. It's like, if I can help one person, and then it has changed into like my ultimate goal is for people to feel seen. And so the fact that was our connections, like, oh, she sees me, she gets me. And then, you know, as our relationship continued to grow, I was like, oh no, you really get me? Like, you're like, oh, you get the real. it just is this beautiful thing.
Well, and I think similarly, you, from your experience, decided to go into law enforcement. That also changed my trajectory. Yeah. I was a business major, like I said, and I changed to psychology with an emphasis in criminal justice. Now, granted, it took me a couple of victory laps to finally complete college, because that was one other thing that he tried to take from me, was my ability to pursue my education. And it took 6 years for me to finally finish. But I did. And then I went on to study for my master's, which was criminal justice with an emphasis in psychology. And while doing that, I became a victim advocate for the police department, the same one that had investigated my crime. So I was the on-call advocate. I was a secondary responder, so I'd have somebody else to go with. And then I worked my way up to a primary. So like I could go on my own or have somebody else, and I would be in charge of the advocacy stuff in that scene. And through that and that training and the accreditation, basically, that you have to get, you learn about so many different things outside of yourself. So when I would go and advocate, much like yours, they'd have no idea that I also was a crime victim. They'd have no clue what I'd been through, because in those moments, it wasn't important for me to disclose what I'd been through. But having the empathy and knowing in my mind, I relate, also helped me with how I would advocate for them. Mm-hmm. I started working at the district attorney's office in 2012. I think it was January of 2012.
The same DA's office.
Yes. Yep. The same one. And it was so cool that I just remember walking up that first day. It was cold outside. And I was walking up outside of the courthouse. I'm like, this is a cool moment. Like, in the corniest of ways, but like,
don't like Elle Woods.
But yes, they did learn that they couldn't shower after a perm at the risk of deactivating the ammonium thioglycolate.
Yes, it's important information. You never know what'll come in handy.
I remember how cool it was. I get the chance to impact victims' lives now in a way that I had mine impacted. And while I may have a very large docket of cases, for those people that I'm meeting with, that is the one and only thing that is important to them at that moment, and I'm going to be as present as possible for it. So I created and ran the Adult Diversion Program for quite a while, which is still in existence and wonderful. And it's run by actually one of my very best friends. And I was really proud of that work, and then started in community relations for them as well before I left to pursue another job. Kara, do you have a question?
So, did anything special happen while you worked at the DA's office? Was there anyone there that was special to you or became special to you?
So weird you should ask.
I know.
You're going to hear lots about him throughout the time that we're on here. And it's always funny because if people ask how we met, we typically just say work, unless we're really looking for that instant dopamine hit of their faces and their jaws just dropping.
Is that dopamine, Kim? I don't know if that's dopamine.
For me, to watch them feel awkward, it is. I enjoy it. I am the mouse hitting that.
How sadistic of you.
I'm going to take my kicks where I can get them, damn it. So when I walked into the district attorney's office as a 20-year-old with my parents and the investigator to meet this team of people who was going to represent me and the state of Colorado, the people versus this attacker, I remember very little from that meeting, frankly. But I do remember that the chief deputy DA was very tall, had dark hair, and was very handsome. And that's pretty much all I remember. Fast forward, that's also now my husband. No kidding. Mike and I met because he prosecuted my case. We remained friends, lost touch for a little while, but we do presentations across the country together on this case and the importance of starting by believing. And there's so many different trainings that we've done, whether it's for prosecutors and law enforcement or universities or whatever it might be. And we were even doing those long before we ever decided, oh my gosh, wait, you've been here all along.
Which is like my favorite, where like you guys met, remained friends. It was nothing like inappropriate or anything. And then at some point, you realize that the person that made you feel the safest and the most comfortable was right there beside you all along.
It was my voice before I could find my own.
Yeah.
And to be able to watch him still do that today for so many other victims and families in our communities. Like, you guys, our pillow talk is massively weird if anybody else were listening to it. But I would say there's always been a magnetism towards each other, born of just awe and respect. And then when that 10 years later changes into something else, it was like when we started dating, it was with a huge amount of intention, because we're like, we know the worst things about each other. And that is my, that's my person. Like that is, I never have to explain the worst things in my life that have happened because he was there with me. And not only that, but fought for me and stood up for me, mm-hmm. along with this incredible team that we're all still very close friends with. I'm not going to feel feelings.
Good luck.
I am going to relentlessly make fun of him and as he does me. But
listen, I think it's safe to say one of the things we share in our marriages is that our primary love language is sarcasm.
Yes.
Just in general. Like, yeah. If we're not being sarcastic with one another, we're probably actually mad at one another.
Right. Like the dark humor that is part of our relationship in general, I don't ever want that to overshadow the fact that I am madly in love with this man. And I know, gross, right?
So gross.
But like, not just because of what he did for me, but because what he continues to do for everyone else. And I am quite certain he would say the same of me. We're both fighting the same fight in different ways. And it just ended up being the story that I never realized I was writing.
Yeah.
I thought it was a true crime story, and it ends up being a love story.
Oh, what?
Yeah. What? Record scratch.
Yeah. You guys are going to hear from Mike later in the season. And, you know, it's funny because if you follow Kim on social media, you know that Mike has this certain persona. It reminds me of like Walter Matthau and grumpy old men.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes.
Like, why are you filming me? But when you sit down and you talk to him, like he really just has the biggest heart and he is just genuine and, you know, he's really doing the right thing and he's doing the hard work. And it's just, it's so fun to see him. I haven't been able to see that side of him necessarily. You know, like I see the caricature side of him and I guess the results of his career, but to sit down and hear him say all the things, it was pretty cool. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, we've already recorded, like we're doing these totally backwards, but we've already recorded that. And I liked it because these things that I hear him talk about constantly. And I mean, the man is on Dateline with a frequency that is silly, but to hear him talk about it and tell you with everything that you know about him too, should also, at some point you will get to hear our husbands together.
Yeah.
Which it is exactly what you think it is, actually.
You know, what is funny is in the same way that Kim and I just formed like an immediate friendship, like the four of us somehow became this weird,
oh my God,
quadruped situation where it's like Mike and I are the same person and like Kim and Joe are the same person. So we were all in Vegas together last year for an event. And there are just these photos where Kim and Joe just look like two clowns. And Mike and I are just looking at them like,
Joe and I needed to be the kids on the leashes. And you two are like, what? I am tired.
That's actually accurate. So, you know, we'll make sure we include that in the show notes. Make sure you head on over for those photos because they are priceless. And
well, if we're publishing that, then we're definitely putting up the one of Joe and Mike snuggling on the couch watching videos. Karen, Joe and family came out here to Colorado, which was the best thing ever.
Yeah. And that was the first time we met in real life. And we were basically like making stupid slow motion running at one another videos immediately.
That does exist too. But I just think about that. I'm like, oh, like obviously you've been here before. Our kids ended up hanging out, like immediately hit it off. It was like they were seeing their cousins or something off the bat. It was so fun.
It was.
And then you guys ended up staying for much longer than anticipated, which I was happy about.
Friends that get COVID together, they stay together.
They podcast together too, apparently.
But yeah, it's been fun. And it's a whole different type of trauma bond, which
I'd say it's positive.
It's the positive side of trauma bonding, right? Like to get your people and to understand.
It's a trauma meet cute.
I love it so much. So what, Kim, is your driving force these days to keep sharing, to be on the podcast, to keep pushing through those days where you're like, I hate the internet and I don't want to be here anymore?
What keeps you going? Your stubbornness.
Yes, my dogged tenacity to piss other people off. I would say I need to come up with a better analogy, but this is what I've got right now. Every single time that I have given a speech, someone comes up to me afterwards and discloses that they were abused in some fashion as well. Every single time. Mm-hmm. We are talking 16 years of this, and without fail, every single one. And those, I look at the fact that they can come up and say that out loud, or that they gained something from listening, or that they just feel empowered enough to be comfortable in their skin for those little moments. That's enough. Mm. All I've ever wanted to do from all of this is just spread this message. I've always said, I don't care if you remember my name or my face. I want you to remember my story. And that's all that I've ever wanted to do, which I think that's what we're doing. And it makes me really excited to bring so many stories together finally, where it's not just me sharing mine or you sharing yours. It's all these other things that people can connect with, these instances or experiences or ways that you have responded to things that you don't feel are, quote, right, are. If you're here today, you've done something right. You've done everything right. If you are still here, if you are listening to this, you're doing it right.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to look like everyone else. So those are the little breadcrumbs along the trail of advocacy that I've constantly looked for. And it's not that it happens every single day, but, you know, Kara and I get DMs, one like she sent me this morning, that
yeah,
it just helps to step outside of the world that we live in, the educations that we pursue, the work that we do within our communities that we're not publicizing. It's not just as if we get online and talk about this stuff. No, we legitimately do things here at our homes, in our own communities, and you can too.
Yeah.
Nothing is stopping you from that. But that's what's always driven me to share. It's helping just at least one person. And sometimes the person that it helps is me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay too.
Right. I love that. We will always be here to support you guys and to tell you that abnormal reactions to abnormal situations are absolutely normal. We want to share our stories. We want to share other people's healing stories so that you can maybe have some resonance with the things that you hear. Because one of the things that keeps the crime of sexual assault, now we will not strictly be talking about sexual assault. We'll be talking about lots of different crimes and victimology, but specifically sexual assault. One of the things that keeps people from healing is this feeling of isolation. And it's something very often that offenders across the board will utilize to keep someone in this victim mentality. And we just want to break that wide open and let you know you're not alone. You're seen, you're heard, your reactions are normal. And honestly, you're going to have days where it sucks and you feel like a victim. But the key to survival, the key to healing is just to pick yourself up and to just keep going. So for me, that is my driving force and my motivation behind sharing my story in this podcast, is just to remind you all that you just have to keep going. As long as you get up one more time than you fall down, you will be successful and you'll make it.
Nobody makes the choice to be victimized, but I think we all have the ability to make the choice to become a survivor in whatever way that looks like to you. And we want to help you do that.
And that's why we are Survivor's Guide to True Crime, because we are sharing true crime stories, but we are sharing how to get from victim to survivor. And we are survivors talking about survivors and making content for survivors. So we are so glad that you're here, that you've joined us. And we hope that this is the beginning of a beautiful, long relationship between us and you. We want to hear from you. We will have mid-season, and at the end of the season, we will have Q&As. Mm-hmm. You can always access us on social media. The best place, if you have questions specifically for the podcast, is survivorsguidetotruecrime.com. You will be able to submit questions there. But we're just so glad that you're here, and we're so honored to be part of your journeys.
I think back to a few years ago when you and I had this idea of bringing together this community of survivors. and not knowing how to go live at the same time on TikTok to where we are now with...
Couldn't at the time. Yeah.
Right. With the incredible team of professionals and just finding us in this space was perfectly fit for us.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want it any other way. You're in good hands when you're here. And we're just thankful for every single person that this is going to impact, because we know that if you're listening to this, you are going to go forth in the world, in your world, and do good too.
Yeah, and you can. And even just our journey to podcasting, like Kim said, it's been a couple years to get it here, but it was kind of right place, right time, right people. It wasn't on our time frame, which is a whole other, you know, commentary on healing. It's not on your time frame. It's going to be a journey. And like Kim said, just hope that we are able to empower you to become the best versions of yourself, to become a survivor. And honestly, just even beyond that, I think survivor is just kind of step one to the rest of your life.
Yep. I will throw a quick PSA in. If you've listened to this and it's impacted you in some way, just make sure you take a minute, do some self-care, whatever that might look like for you. Be really present with how you're feeling. And it may not even be something that you realize until a day or two afterwards. That's definitely part of that healing cycle or consuming any kind of trauma or stress when it's vicarious like this. So please watch out for yourselves, watch out for each other. And we'd love to have you back next week.
Yeah.
Because we have incredible stuff to talk about.
We have so much good stuff this season, you guys. I mean, it's gonna blow your mind. But yeah, we will always have show notes and resources on our website. We have them individually on our own website. Like Kim said, make sure to check out the website for resources for taking care of yourself. Mm-hmm. We will always point you back to the trained professionals who are there 24/7 if you are in crisis, whether that be RAIN or the 988 crisis and suicide prevention hotline. There are so many amazing resources, people who are highly, highly trained and always available to respond when you are in crisis. So please make sure you take care of yourself, and we'll see you next week, right? Y'all will be here.
Heck yeah. And guys, we love feedback. Anything that you can give us, help us learn and educate. This is supposed to be a two-way street. So leave your feedback, leave your ratings and your reviews. Help us find more people just like you who may need to hear this. So thank you so much for holding space for my story today, for Kara's, and everyone to come.
Yes. All right. See you next week, guys.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.